1 year later. Coming up on The Invasion, A Look Back, we interview the courageous members of Australia's Royal 11th Brigade, who staged a daring raid on a Mogadorian warship on VH Day. But first, the Lorik, gods, heroes, illegal immigrants. Our panel discusses. I turn off the television. It gets terrible reception way up here anyway. With the background noise gone, I can focus totally on my scrubbing. My hand's a little sore from gripping the brush, pushing it back and forth across the stone wall. It'd be easier just to use my telekinesis, but I like the work. It feels good to use my hands. To worry at these ancient paint stains until they flake away, or until my forearms are too tired to continue. Used to be there was a painting on this wall of 8 getting run through by a sword. Now that's completely gone. I scrubbed that one away first. The only prophecy left here is the painting of the earth split in half. One part alive, the other dead, with two ships approaching the planet from opposite sides. The one I'm rubbing away now. I actually kind of like this one, which is why I saved it for last. My reading is that the painter didn't know who would win the war for Earth. That's why they left it so vague. It still has to go. I'm trying not to dwell on the past so much anymore. I want this place to be about the future. So I keep scrubbing.
I think it's clean, John.
Ella's voice breaks me out of my trance. I'm not sure how long I've been scouring the wall. Hours, maybe. The muscles in my arm are numb. I've probably been buffing stone for a while. The painting completely erased. Spaced out for a bit, I say sheepishly.
Yeah, I've been sitting here for about 10 minutes, she replies.
Ella tracked me down a few months ago, and has been hanging around ever since. I'm still not exactly sure how she did it. I guess being a telepath probably helped. In the Himalayas, I thought I'd found a pretty good place to hide out for a while to get my head straight. I heard about this cavern from Marina and Six, back when they were on the run in India. This chamber of prophecies suffered a cave-in during a Moog attack. I'd arrived intending to excavate and see if anything could be salvaged, but those Vishnu Nationalist 8 guys had beaten me to it. Apparently, the cave is a revered place for them. They'd already started digging it out and let me join their efforts with no questions asked. These days, they secure the area, keep random hikers away, and generally stay out of my hair. I guess one of them could have leaked my location to Ella, but I kind of doubt it. Looking at her, I think there's still something a little otherworldly about Ella. The crazy spark that used to be in her eyes has faded, although right now, bathed in the cobalt blue light of this cavern, I see some of Lorien lingering in her pupils. Maybe she saw me and my project in one of her visions and decided to come help. I don't mind the company. Ella's grown up a lot over the past 12 months, entered those real gawky teenage years that I don't miss one bit. Her face is suntanned from being outside, her hair braided like one of the locals. She goes to school in the little village down the mountain, and the 7 other kids in her class pretend like she's not different at all. She sits cross-legged on the massive table I've installed in the center of this cavern, my project, picking a thread on the tarp I've got covering it.
So the walls are clean, Ella says.
Yeah.
Now you've got no reason left to procrastinate.
I look away from her. She's been needling me on an almost daily basis to go out and find the others. I always intended to. The work I'm doing up here, it's not just for me. However, I think a part of me came to enjoy the solitude and the rooted feeling of the Himalayas.
When was the last time I got to stay in one place without constantly looking over my shoulder? Plus, I'm a little nervous about tracking everyone down. A lot can change in a year. From behind her back, Ella pulls out the wooden cigar box where I've been storing the other pieces of my project. She holds it out to me.
"I took the liberty of getting this for you," she says. "You can leave right away."
I narrow my eyes at her. "I wish you wouldn't go through my stuff."
"Come on, John. We're telepaths. You know boundaries are hard."
I take the box from her. "You just want to see mine again." Ella's eyes widen.
"Hey, now who's snooping?"
She's right, though. It's time. No more putting this off. Outside the cave, there's a little snow on the mountain. I jog down the rocky path into the sunny day, feeling the weather warm up as I get lower. The air is crisp and clean, and I take a deep breath, wanting to savor it. Or maybe wanting to stall. I stop just before I reach the small encampment that's home to a rotating group of Vishnu Nationalist 8 soldiers. One of them spots me and waves. I wave back. I take a deep breath. I'm going to miss my solitude. Then I leap up in the air. It's been a little while since I've flown. Even though I'm a little rusty, I'm still better at it now than I was a year ago. As I soar through clouds, feeling their chill moisture on my skin, I have to resist the urge to let out a cheer. It feels good to be out here. It feels good to be stretching my legacies in a way that I haven't in a while. It feels good to be flying towards a situation that won't be deadly. Well, hopefully not anyway. Of course, as soon as I have that thought, two giant paws strike me right between the shoulder blades and send me tumbling towards the earth. I shout as I manage to right myself. As soon as I'm safely floating, the griffin makes another pass. I dodge through the clouds, avoiding its beak, its claws, laughing all the while. "I'm sorry I didn't say bye to you," I yell at BK. "You were off sunning yourself somewhere, you lazy mutt!" The Chimera seems to accept my apology, because instead of coming in for another attack, he flies alongside me. I hook onto one of my old friend's massive feathered wings and let him pull me forwards for a while, laughing and stroking his fur. Before we leave India's airspace, BK shakes loose, gives me a friendly roar, and turns back. "I'll be home soon, BK," I shout into the wind. I put my arms to my sides, keep my legs close together, chin pressed to my chest. It's my most aerodynamic posture. I turn myself invisible and settle in, my mind emptying out just like when I was scrubbing those cavern walls. I guess I've become the kind of guy who meditates. It's going to be a long flight. They're building the academy in a secluded patch of forest just across the bay from San Francisco. As I descend, I can see the Golden Gate Bridge and the city beyond. Below me, newly constructed dormitories and lecture halls rise up from the greenery. Cranes and cement trucks park nearby where the work isn't yet finished. It's like a quaint private school, if you ignore what hides beyond the forested perimeter. An electrified fence, barbed wire, heavily armed soldiers patrolling the academy's only exit road. Ostensibly, all that is to keep the human guard safe. I wonder, though, what would happen if one of the human guard decided they had enough schooling and wanted to wander off campus? Would the soldiers manning the gate allow that? I don't ponder that question for long. That's not why I'm here. For all their security, the academy isn't prepared for invisible flying men. I land on the campus without being detected. This place was built as part of the Declaration of Guard Governance,
a set of laws adopted by the United Nations after Victory Humanity Day. Teenagers from around the world will be sent here to learn how to control their powers and, eventually, to work towards the betterment of humanity. There are other laws, too. Stuff about the Lorik and the Moogs. Rules about when legacies can be used, that kind of thing. To be honest, I haven't really read them. The campus is largely deserted right now. From what I've heard, the only students currently training here are the ones with no place else to go. The ones who lost their families during the invasion. The rest won't be showing up for a few months when the place opens for real. In the entryway, there's a blown-up poster of an image that circulated everywhere during the cleanup effort that followed the invasion. In it, the president's daughter stands astride a pile of rubble in New York City, using her super strength to lift a stack of debris so that a mother clutching her two young children can safely escape from underneath. In the background, a glamorously tattered American flag waves. The news reports claim that family was stuck down there for a week. But I always thought the whole thing looked staged. Inspiring, yeah, but staged. Across the bottom of the poster, the slogan reads, "Earth Guard Peacekeepers, you are the brave new world." Still invisible, I walk through the halls of the academy. It doesn't take long until I hear the sounds of training. I head in that direction, knowing that's where he'll be. In an outsized gymnasium, a handful of kids practice their telekinesis with each other. Pairs of them toss footballs back and forth without using their hands. And every time a whistle blows, they add another ball to the mix. When a group lets one of their balls drop, they heave a collective groan and start running laps. Nine observes all this from a catwalk high above. He's dressed like a football coach, sweatpants and hoodie. One of his sleeves is pinned up on account of his missing arm. His dark hair is tied back in a ponytail. I thought maybe the government would make him cut it, but no such luck.
"Professor Nine, how long do we have to keep doing this?"
one of the kids complains, and I have to stifle my laughter.
"Until I get tired of watching you screw up, McCarthy," Nine barks back.
I float up to the catwalk and land gently next to Nine. He senses the movement and turns his head just as I become visible.
"Look at this sellout working for the gov."
Oof! Nine nearly clotheslines me off the catwalk with his one-armed hug. When he's done squeezing the life out of me, he holds me out at arm's length, studying me like I was just secretly studying him.
"Johnny Hero, holy shit!" Nine shakes his head. "You're here!"
"I'm here." Detecting a lack of movement from the kids below, Nine looks down. His group of orphaned guard have all stopped practicing to stare up at us. To stare at me, in particular.
"What the hell?" he shouts. "Back to work, you maggots!"
Reluctantly, the kids do as they're told. I can't help but grin at Nine's control over them. He turns back to me and pinches my cheek, where I realize I've got a patchy beard growing. It's probably been a few months since I shaved.
"This peach fuzz supposed to make you incognito?"
Nine asks.
"It ain't working!"
"Professor Nine, huh?" I respond, smirking.
"That's right,"
he says, puffing out his chest. "You never even finished high school, man."
"It's an honorary title," he replies with a devilish smile. "Look at you, all reclusive mountain man and shit. Where you been? You know, it wasn't cool you skipping out on us after my crippled ass spent a week nursing you back to health."
I snort at that. "You weren't nursing me, you were laid up in the next bed."
"Yeah, providing important emotional support."
I know Nine's joking, but there's a bit of truth to what he says. After West Virginia, as soon as I was feeling well enough, I did bail on the others.
I rub the back of my neck.
I feel bad about that. I needed to get my head right after...
Aw, shut up about it, Nine says, patting me on the shoulder. You're back now.
He nods his head at the kids below, many of whom are still furtively glancing at us, screwing up their telekinetic tosses and thus running a lot of laps.
You want to say a few words to the next generation? They'd eat that shit up. These are my favorites, the messed up ones. They remind me of us.
I take a step back from the catwalk's railing and shake my head. I'm not ready for anything like that, I tell him. From behind my back, I pull out the small box I've been carrying with me since the Himalayas. I actually came here to give you something. Lexa, too, if she's around.
Nine raises an eyebrow at me.
Yeah, let's go say hi. I've got something I want to show you.
Nine dismisses his class and leads me to an office on the building's third floor. It looks out over the sprawling campus. Or it will once the windows are put in. Right now, there are a bunch of blue tarps covering the open spaces in the wall. Lexus sits behind a desk, staring at a multi-screen computer rig. Like Nine, she's dressed casually and seems at ease here. Her smile is wide when she recognizes me, and she immediately leaves her screens behind to give me a hug.
So, are you a professor too? I ask her.
Lexa scoffs.
No, Nine outpaced me there. I'm back to my favorite role, benevolent hacker.
She waves me around the desk for a look.
Check it out.
At a glance, it's hard to take in all the information that flows across Lexa's screens. There are world maps with little blue dots, multiple search bots trawling the internet, dark net forums, and boxes of encrypted data speeding through processes I don't understand. So, what am I looking at?
I'm keeping tabs on the guard, she explains, scrubbing their information if it gets made public, keeping their families confidential. Even once they're under the protection of the Academy, you can't be too careful. Not to mention, some governments still aren't super enthusiastic about this whole initiative.
Is this necessary?
Better safe than sorry, she responds. Lawson and the other Earth Guard people have been good to us, but...
But then there's shit like this that makes you wonder,
Nine interjects, handing me a piece of official-looking government stationery. I give it a quick read. I, the undersigned... affirm that I am a naturally born human of Earth and a law-abiding citizen of an Earth Guard nation. With my signature, I pledge an oath to Earth Guard, a fully sanctioned peacekeeping division created by the United Nations and administered by the United States. I do solemnly swear that I will defend the planet and the best interests of my nation and its allies against all enemies, earthly and extraterrestrial, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the Earth Guard, that I will only use my legacies in service to my planet, and that I will obey the orders of the jointly appointed Earth Guard High Command according to regulations and the Uniform Code of Military Justice. I look up at Nine, feeling a little bewildered. Is this legal?
I don't know, John. I'm a professor, not a lawyer.
Lawson assures us that it's just a formality, Lexa interjects. But we're keeping our eyes open just in case.
Well, if it ever looks like they're not on the level, I start to say, then show the two of them what I've brought with me. In New York City, the rebuilding is still in progress. A year later, and they're still hauling away the debris from the Mogadorian bombardment. In places they've finished clearing out, construction crews are getting ready to put the city's skyline back together. A similar process is happening in major cities all around the world. VH Day wasn't without damage or casualties. I float above a construction site, smiling at a familiar flash of silver energy. In a pit that will one day become a skyscraper, Daniela uses her stone vision to shore up a cracked section of foundation.
Shit, grouses a guy in a hard hat. You keep that up, I'm gonna be out of a job, honey.
I ain't your honey, old man, Daniela replies, and elbows her way through a crowd of construction workers. By the way, they watch her strut away, grinning and exchanging glances. I think this might be a pretty common scene. Daniela climbs out of the construction site and heads to the sidewalk, where she's approached by a middle-aged woman who walks with a cane. The lady stops to hug Daniela, and Daniela stoops to pet the golden retriever the woman has on a leash. The woman looks familiar, and it takes me a minute to figure out why.
You forgot your lunch, baby, the woman says.
Thanks, Mom, replies Daniela. Not every scene that I encounter during my trip around the world is a sweet one. Some endings aren't so happy. It's night in Montreal when I find Karen Walker. She walks across an almost deserted airport parking lot, a trench coat drawn up to protect her from the cold evening air, a newspaper tucked under her arm, her heels clicking. There's only one other person in the long-term parking lot, a pale, middle-aged man with a terrible comb-over who drags an overstuffed rolling suitcase behind him. One of the parking lot's light poles is out, leaving a small row of cars bathed in shadows. When the man reaches that section, Walker yells to him,
"Excuse me," she calls, waving the newspaper. "Excusez-moi, you dropped your paper."
The man turns around, puzzled.
"Huh? That's not..."
Two silenced rounds from the gun hidden inside her newspaper, one in the chest and one in the head. The man never saw it coming. He drops, and Walker goes to him immediately. She starts dragging the body into the shadowy space between two cars. I help her out with my telekinesis, appearing a few feet away. She jumps, points her gun at me, then quickly lowers it and pretends she wasn't startled in the first place.
"John!"
"Karen," I reply. "I hope you've got a good reason for this."
"I do,"
she replies. Walker unzips the dead man's suitcase and tosses aside a pile of his clothes. She digs around until she discovers a dog-eared copy of the Bible. She opens the book, revealing that it's hollowed out. Inside are three vials of black oil. My skin crawls at the sight of it.
"How much of that is out in the world?" I ask her.
"I don't know," Walker says. "Any amount over none is too much for me."
Walker produces a vial of her own from within her trench coat. By the rotten egg smell, I think hers is sulfuric acid. Carefully, she pours some into each of the Mogadorian vials, destroying the contents.
"Who was this man?" I ask her.
"Just a name on a list,"
she replies, looking me in the eyes.
"A really long list. You know, I could use some help working through it."
I take out my cigar box and open it up. "We can talk about that soon." Seeing that sludge brings me back to our last battle with Cetricus Ra. Everything after I locked up with Cetricus Ra is like a dream. I remember how broken my body was, how destroyed. And I remember a vision of Sarah, a hallucination leaning down to kiss me, to make me keep going. I remember flying, up, out, leaving that heat behind, escaping the stench of death. I remember Bernie Kosar's coat, soft against my caved-in face. I remember the sound of someone crying, and I remember us stopping short, still inside the mountain. I remember being able to open my eyes just enough to see a gray-furred creature, part wolf, but with legs like a spider, covered in dried blood, motionless, a chimera frozen in its last form. And I remember Adam cradling that chimera, dust, and crying into the fur of his neck.
"He pulled me out. He saved me,"
I remember Adam saying to Six, delirious near death himself. I closed my eyes for good after that.
I couldn't stand to see any more.
I'd learn what happened later, how dust dove down after Adam, took on a shape that would let him climb out of the chasm, and dragged Adam as far as he could away from the caverns. He had to bite Adam to carry him to safety, and after he died, one of Dust's fangs was still embedded in Adam's shoulder. Adam wears that fang around his neck now, attached to a plain leather strap. It's one of the few comforts he's allowed here in Alaska. When I find him, Adam is standing in front of a small bonfire, his hands shoved into a threadbare winter coat. It's freezing out here. Adam's dark hair, grown longer than before, pokes out from beneath a wool hat. Even bundled up, he shivers. Snow blows in sideways. It's mid-afternoon and there's no sunlight. This part of Alaska, 50 miles north of the nearest town, doesn't get a lot of light this time of year. This specially constructed prison camp is where the UN put the Mogadorians that surrendered, the ones that were captured. The Vatborn fought to the last. They didn't know any better. The Trueborns, however, self-preservation kicked in for some of them, especially once Cetricus Ra was killed. A dozen long houses with spotty heating, food airdropped in, and nothing else. A village of Mogadorians in the middle of nowhere, one with a perimeter of UN soldiers who outnumber the surviving Mogs 20-1 at all times. There are missiles aimed here perpetually, drones designed to withstand the elements fly overhead. There was talk about executing them all. There still is. For now, the captured Mogs stay here and wait.
"I renounce the teachings of the Great Liar!"
shouts a Mog with scars across his bald head from where he carved off his tattoos. He throws a copy of the Great Book into the bonfire, and a small huddle of Mogs, Adam and Rex among them, come forward to hug and congratulate him. Maybe there's hope for rehabilitation. Another larger contingent of Mogs watch the book burners. There's nothing but malice in their eyes. One of them in particular stands out to me. She's a dark-haired girl a few years younger than Adam, with his same sharp features. This girl and her group seem like they want nothing more than to murder Adam's followers, and, judging by the scrapes and bruises on the faces of some of Adam's trueborn friends, there have been attempts. Adam stares back at the trueborn malcontents watching him, his chin raised in defiance. A siren blares overhead, a warning that the Mogs need to disperse. One of the rules here is that they aren't supposed to gather in large numbers. As the chastened Mogs head back to their destitute bunks, I float down alongside Adam. "Probably wouldn't be a good idea for me to be seen here, huh?" I whisper to him without turning visible. The siren is loud enough to mask my voice. Adam's whole body tenses, his fists ball, and for a moment I think he's about to swing at me. He's on edge and afraid of getting snuck up on. "Easy now," I say. "It's me." Adam quickly regains his composure. He kneels down in the snow and pretends to tie his boot. The other Mogs from his group drift sullenly towards the longhouse, giving us room.
"John,"
Adam says quietly, the ghost of a smile on his face.
"It's good to see. It's good to hear your voice."
I put my hand on Adam's shoulder without turning him invisible, too. I let my lumen trigger a bit, radiating some heat.
"You're going to spoil me,"
he says with a sigh. "I could get you out of here right now," I say. "No one would know."
"My people would notice when there was no one here to defend them from the others," he replies sadly. "And besides, technically, I can leave at any time."
This is true. Owing to his role in fighting off the Mogadorian invasion, Adam received a pardon pushed through by General Lawson himself. He elected not to use it. When the captured Trueborn started getting shipped into Alaska, Adam was here waiting for them. "I saw a girl in the crowd who looked like you," I say tentatively, not sure how nosy I should be.
My sister,
Adam replies gloomily.
She loved our father. I think she hates me now. But maybe one day.
What about your mother? I ask. Adam shakes his head.
She disappeared. Maybe she died fighting in the invasion. Maybe she's in hiding. A part of me hopes she'll show up here one day, and a part of me hopes that she doesn't.
You don't want her to have to live here, I say.
More like I'm worried whose side she would be on,
Adam says.
It's bleak, John, but this is my duty now. I'm doing more good here than I could do anywhere else.
I let that sink in. I hate to see my friend up here lumped in with the rest of them, so I don't want to come out and agree. But he could be right. I take Adam's hand and press an object from my wooden box into it. He looks down, startled at the cobalt blue glow that radiates from his palm. Quickly, he hides what I gave him underneath his shirt. For when you're ready. I've already gone out of my way by visiting Alaska before my next destination. It's my last stop to make in North America. I've put it off long enough. I haven't been back to Paradise since Sam and I snuck back into town to seek out his dad's hidden bunker. I almost got myself killed that night, but I just had to try seeing Sarah. I break out in a cold sweat as soon as the small town comes into view. My eyes are drawn to the James's house. The roof is caved in, the sides still black and charred. They never rebuilt after the fire that happened there during Mark's party, the one where I got caught jumping out his window. I never got along with Mark. We never liked each other. He did his best to help us, though. He did good. And he died in a horrible way that he didn't deserve. In all the retrospectives they've been playing on television, no one mentions Mark James. Someday, I think maybe I'd like to track down his father. I did some quick internet sleuthing, but could only find out that he quit his sheriff's job and left Paradise. I'd like to tell him what happened to Mark, and what he did for us before he died, even if he might not want to hear that. There are some things I'm not ready for. That's one of them. The other is here, too. I land in the Good family's backyard, happy to find Malcolm working in the garden. It takes me a minute of watching him to realize why the patch of earth he's tending looks so strange. It's where his bunker used to be hidden. Looks like Malcolm and Mrs. Good decided to level the old well that used to lead down to Malcolm's secret chamber. In the fresh soil, they've planted flowers of every conceivable color. I assume Pittacus Lore's body is still buried underneath there, and, if so, I imagine he'd be pleased with this resting place. Malcolm hugs me for a long time when I surprise him. My eyes well up when he does. It's the place. I can't help thinking about everything that happened here. I can't help imagining for just a second that Malcolm is Henri. After I give him the same gift that I've given all the others, Malcolm tries to get me to stay for dinner. I can't, I tell him. Too much left to do. He shakes his head ruefully.
Still off saving the world, huh?
Nothing quite so serious, I reply. I'm going to visit Sam next.
Tell him to call his mother,
Malcolm says with a shake of his head,
and tell him he needs to come home eventually and finish high school, or he'll never get into a good college. There's a limit to how much vacation a young man should be allowed to take, no matter how many planets he's helped save.
Laughing, I promise to tell Sam all that. Then I fly out of Malcolm's backyard, turn invisible again, and land a few houses over. Sarah Hart's house. I stand on the front walk, not turning visible, not moving. It's just like I remember it. I imagine jogging up the sidewalk and ringing the doorbell. How excited I would be to see her, my heart racing. She'd invite me in and her house would smell amazing, like it always would, and we'd... There's no movement in the windows. The house is dark.
There's a for sale sign driven into the front yard. I've imagined this 100 times over the last year. How I would come here and ring the doorbell like old times. How I would see Sarah's parents and tell them how much I love their daughter. How much she meant to me. How much she meant to the world. Even if not many people know it. And how sorry I am that I dragged her into everything that happened. I would tell them that I miss her every day. And then I would throw myself on their mercy. I've imagined it so many times, but I can't do it. I can't take that walk up those steps. I'm too scared. I don't want to see the look in their eyes. I don't want to grapple with the pain I've caused them. Maybe someday I'll be ready. Not today. In their tour of Europe, Six and Sam have made it to Montenegro by the time I catch up with them. They're camping on a secluded part of Jazz Beach. Even at night, the water shines like crystal. The purple swells of the nearby hills a stunning contrast. I'm happy for them. The way they've traveled, how much they've seen in a year. And at the same time, my heart aches because it isn't me. On the beach, I find their campfire and their tent, but I don't find Six or Sam. No. For that, I need to follow the trail of clothes towards the water's edge. I see them out there, silhouettes in the moonlight, tangled together in the water. I laugh quietly and look away. I'm not going to be a third wheel here, even if I do miss them both badly. I also haven't talked to Six since... well, since she saved my life. A life that I was more than ready to throw away. Like Sarah's family, I'm not sure what I'll say to her. For now, better to let it go unsaid. From inside my wooden box, I withdraw 2 pendants. They're carved from laurolite stone that I chipped off the main rock back in the Himalayas. Chiseled into both of them is the Lorik symbol for unity. I drape these across their sleeping bags and find a scrap of paper to write them a short note. I let them know how the pendants work, that they just need to visualize the Himalayas and it should bring them to the chamber I've set up, the one I've scrubbed clean of the past and made ready for the future. I write that I hope I'll see them soon, and I mean it. Marina is the hardest to find. If it wasn't for her sporadic phone calls to Ella over the last few months, it might have taken me weeks to track her down. When I would ask her about Marina, Ella would always get quiet. She said Marina didn't seem like herself, that she seemed paranoid, angry. I find her navigating a speedboat between deserted islands in the South Pacific. Her face is sunburned, her wavy hair crisped straight from salt water, and there are deep bags under her eyes. I get the feeling that she's been alone for a while. I recognize the signs. I've seen them in myself. Her lips move when she's not talking. Her hands shake. Her eyes don't always stay focused. We were raised in a war, and now we're free. Everyone is handling it differently. When I first appear to her, she doesn't startle as much as the others. "Are you really there? Or have I truly gone crazy?" she asks me. "I'm here, Marina." She smiles that gentle, patient smile. I'm glad to see it.
"Thank God," she says. "You showed up at a good time."
I don't ask her where we're going. She drives the boat purposefully, like she'd made this trip before. I lean back and let the spray tickle my cheeks, feel the sun beat down on my neck and shoulders. Eventually, Marina hands me a cell phone. Our fingers brush, and I notice that she's ice cold.
"I saw this on the internet, and I couldn't let it go," she says.
She plays a video that she downloaded off YouTube. Of course, I recognize the scene. It's the mountain in West Virginia, or what's left of it. Really, it's a crater filled with scorched rubble,
the end result of our bombardment of that hellish place. The video was shot a week after our last battle there, when various government agencies had begun picking over the remains. As a crew clears away some rocks, something knocks them backwards. A shape streaks upwards from the debris like a missile and disappears into the sky. The camera tries to follow it, but isn't nearly quick enough.
"We never got that fourth scar, John,"
Marina says, her voice a little shaky. "Maybe the charm was broken," I say.
"I thought that for a while. Tried to convince myself."
She shakes her head.
"I know the kinds of places he likes. I remember from when he told us about himself. Warm and tropical. Secluded."
"And?"
"I found him last week,"
Marina says. Marina cuts the boat's engine as we approach a small island. It would probably take you less than an hour to walk its entire perimeter. Just white sand and a small copse of palm trees. We drift closer, the waves tugging us in. The guy standing on the beach with a wooden fishing pole in his hands looks frighteningly skinny. From where we are, I can see the outline of his ribs and spine. There are loose flaps of skin on his arms and belly from where the weight came off too quick. More disconcerting are the dark patches of skin, like tumors, like hardened obsidian that make a patchwork of his skin. Maybe that's a result of being drowned in Cetricus Ra's lake of ooze. Another permanent disfigurement to go with the missing eye. That is most definitely Five standing there. There's no chance he doesn't see us. There aren't any other boats for as far as the eye can see. He probably heard us coming miles off.
"When I saw him die, John, all I could think was how horrible it was to be killed in that way."
Marina begins hesitantly, staring across the shallows at Five.
"But I also felt, I'm not proud to admit this, I also felt there was justice there, that he had at last gotten what was coming to him."
Marina hugs herself. Even in the sun, a light frost forms on her skin.
"I've prayed, John. I've tried to get over it, like so many of the others have done. But the deaths haunt me. Not just Eight, but Sarah and Mark, Adelina and Creighton. All those people we saw on the mountain, the millions killed in the bombardment. And I think, how can anyone just move on? How? When there are still people like him in the world. When there is no justice."
I swallow hard. "I don't know, Marina.
I've been coming here for a week, sitting out here, watching him. He knows we're here. Obviously, even if he doesn't say anything, it's like he's daring me, or he's asking for it. He wants me to put him out of his misery."
Looking across the water, Five does look to be in rough shape. Left to his own devices, I'm not sure how much longer he'll last out here.
"You told me, John, that it would be up to me what happens to him. After, you said. But I do not want that responsibility. I don't want to keep carrying this around. Him. The war. All of it. It is too much to bear alone."
I put my arms around Marina. She's cold to the touch. So I turn on my lumen, counteracting her chill. She cries. One hard sob. And then claps a hand over her mouth. She steels herself, knowing that Five will probably hear. "Let's get out of here," I say, producing the last of my pendants. "Let me take you someplace where we can figure out what's next. Together." Marina hesitates, staring at Five.
"What about him?"
"He's a ghost," I reply. "We aren't." Marina comes back to the Himalayas with me.
When she sees what I've done with the cave, with Eight's cave, she runs her hands across the places where the prophecies used to be etched, feeling the smoothness of new stone, the possibility of a blank canvas. She lets herself cry at last. After that, Marina stands right in front of me. She reaches out and takes my face in her hands.
"Thank you, John,"
she says quietly. The tears haven't dried on her cheeks. I brush a streak away. She kisses me. I don't know what it means. Maybe nothing. Marina blushes, smiles at me, and slowly pulls away. I smile back. This Himalayan cave is suddenly a lot warmer. Maybe something. In the center of the cavern, I pull back the tarp to show Marina what I've spent the last year working on. Carved from trees I cut down off the mountainside, it's a table that uses the laurelite stone as a base. It is huge and circular, and modeled off my memories of the table in the center of the Elder's Chamber on Lorien. Like the pendants, I've used my lumen to burn the Loric symbol for unity into the wood. Eventually, the others will come. Some of them only for a visit, some of them for a longer stay. One day, I hope, this will become a place where great ideas are exchanged, a place kept safe from the corruption and pettiness of governments, where the safety of Earth and the happiness of its people are assured. There are threats still facing this planet. Ones that need a united front of Loric, humans, and even Moogs. We will gather here to solve those problems. Us. The Guard. Our old allies, and ones we haven't even met yet. In the meantime, we have more than enough things to figure out, together and apart. Finding our places in this new world, making amends with those we've hurt, living up to our potential. These are the truly scary things. There is one difference between the table I built here and the table used by the elders. I didn't carve 9 specific spaces in the wood. There's no spot for Laurytus or Cetricus or Pittacus. There aren't even 9 chairs. There's as many as we need there to be, more than enough room. And if it gets too crowded, we can squeeze. I'm done with numbers.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of United as One, Book 7 of the Lorien Legacies by Pittacus Lore, performed by Neil Kaplan, Devin Sorvery, and Bruce Thomas. This program was produced by Dion Audio Services. The director was Jeremy Kochis. Executive producer, Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright 2016 by Pittacus Lore. Production copyright 2016 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.